Hey, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I'm just popping in to tell you that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. September 8th, that's the date for many Vermont students to return to school, at least part of the time for some, and again for some with at least some in-person instruction. But there is a pall of uncertainty hanging over something that in a normal year would mark a familiar ritual welcoming the transition from summer into fall. 2020 instead is a year marked by a global pandemic, and bringing kids and teachers back into school under the same roof with all the health implications and risks involved in that decision has a lot of parents and school officials worried. Guidance is being sought, and today on Vermont Edition, we're speaking with a Vermont official tasked in large part, with providing that guidance. Dan French is the Secretary of Education for the state of Vermont. He's been a presence at the governor's now twice-weekly media briefings on the state's response to COVID-19. He is joining us today to answer your questions about the return to school, even if technically that will include some remote learning along with in-person instruction, what's being called a hybrid approach by splitting the school week into a combination of the two. And welcome to the program today. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mitch. It's great to be here.
So, Secretary French, the date for returning to school wasn't announced until late last month. Now, the regular start date for school was pushed back until September 8th, but the schools were closed initially way back in March. I mean, it's not as all this is all happening over the last couple of weeks. Why has it taken so long to come up with a strategy for resuming the educational year when there were literally months to plan for this? And why was that announcement for a start date made so late in the game?
Yeah, it's interesting, the benefit of hindsight, but it's hard to remember sometime how long we've been in this emergency. It seems like forever, but it's only been a matter of months. And I can remember back to the beginning of May, under the governor's emergency order, where I was required to articulate out a direction for graduations and how the end of the school year was going to go. So it was only in the first week of May or so that we understood how the school year was going to end back in the spring. So, that was sort of job number one. And then, like everyone else in the country, we started to think about reopening in the fall. And a large part of that conversation was about, what do we do in the summer? I think in the school world, I've been a 20-year educator in Vermont. We think of the summer as sort of that opportunity for remediation and the school year's over and so forth. And I think along with our partners around the country, everyone started to realize that, the emergency is not over come summer, that really we had to put our efforts into planning for the fall. And that's where we put all our efforts into. And as you know, I think in mid-June, we were able to publish our initial guidance on reopening schools, which was, I would say, fairly early relative to some other states and also very comprehensive relative to other states. So, unprecedented situation, but, I think we've done as best we can in terms of the timeliness of that. And certainly our interest in giving districts an extra a week or so was based on an assessment of the hard work that's now going on at the local level.
Is that extra week or so enough time, though, for teachers and everybody involved in the schools to prepare for this? What have you been hearing from teachers on that front?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, I would divide the feedback into two categories. One is just, logistical considerations, like how do we do this? And certainly part of the reason for issuing the revised guidance that we did earlier in the week was to address many of the implementation questions, but we're also handling those through frequently asked questions. I think the other half of the equation is really about anxiety, which is totally understandable.
Yeah.
In particular, I would say largely being fed by national media and what's going on in other states. And part of the communication challenge for us in that regard is to constantly say, look, Vermont's conditions are not Texas conditions. So, as secretary, and I have the benefit of Vermont being connected to all our educators pretty well, someone will send me a headline from Texas. And I'm like, well, Texas has a 25% positivity rate. Vermont has a 0.5% positivity rate. Texas is still going forward with football. We have very restrictive measures on sports, so it's hard for us to constantly make that message. But I think it's really important for folks to understand that all our thinking is based on an assessment of our conditions. And our primary focus is to keep everyone safe, and we think we can do that. It's certainly the consensus of our medical community. And we wouldn't hesitate to make different decisions if the data supported that. But we feel pretty confident right now we're in a good shape to reopen schools.
Didn't a lot of districts, though, already have their plans released when, you know, before the state came up and said, okay, we're going to start on September 8th and we're going to have this hybrid approach, which we're going to get to in just a moment. Didn't districts already have plans in place? Didn't they have to change those plans?
Not really. I think, you know, basically my understanding is certainly some folks came out earlier than others, but we still have districts who are adopting plans this week and others are going through revisions of their plans after, you know, constant feedback, in particular from parents, on how to reopen schools. But I meet regularly with the superintendents in particular, and I have another group I meet with on a weekly basis that includes, all the other associations, including Vermont NEA. So we're aware of those challenges, and we understand that any change to our guidance creates problems from a logistics standpoint in terms of, as you mentioned, people have already committed to a trajectory of how they're going to reopen. On the other hand, if there's an opportunity for us, you know, to refine those plans so they're more understandable, to provide more information, we're going to do that. But also importantly, if there's new information emerging from the health science, I think we're compelled to try to have our guidance be informed by that.
Well, the plan right now is for most districts, again, most of them, to take a hybrid approach. And that means a couple of days of in-person learning and then some days devoted to remote learning from home. But unless I'm mistaken, in the past couple of weeks, the administration has urged districts to start to move steadily towards 5 days a week traditional in-person instruction. And I'm just wondering if that doesn't send a mixed message to parents and teachers.
Yeah, I think your characterization isn't quite accurate, but I would agree it's a dynamic situation. But firstly, hybrid can mean lots of things. And for instance, the example where you're pointing to, the idea of having younger students in particular be in school for in-person instruction and older students be remote is a very common configuration of the hybrid model. It isn't necessarily the same students being at home and then being in school, on odd days during the week, though that is a model that's pretty common, particularly in Chittenden County. So the question of hybrid learning, you know, once again, which has emerged as sort of a national phenomena, and we don't have any experience with this as a state, includes many different options. So it's important, I think, you know, we decided as we, you know, based on a knowledge of the operational, I'll say, variability of our school districts, that they were going to need some flexibility to navigate their unique challenges in terms of staffing and their facilities and so forth. So we wanted to be very restrictive on the health guidance because, you know, once again, we've been able to demonstrate as a state that if we cling tightly to the science, we're able to do that fairly successfully. But when it comes time to the sort of the operational or the implementation side of that, we knew districts were going to have some flexibility because the conditions in our districts just vary so significantly.
Oh, I understand the flexibility part for sure. I guess what I'm confused about is this idea that the urging of schools to get back to the all in-person instruction. Why say that if you're going to be, you know, putting in plan in place or approving a lot of these hybrid approaches? As you say, there are different circumstances in each district, but it seems like there are two messages here. We want you to get back to all-time in-person instruction, and yes, we're embracing this hybrid approach. Isn't there a disconnect there?
Yeah, I think there is. I think in particular, once again, when you point to the national narrative, which is much stronger, I'd say, of a drumbeat of in-person or insistent towards in-person, I think we've certainly emerged with broader consensus listening to our medical professionals. And that's one of the changes we did make in our guidance recently is we do include an emphatic statement that, you know, it's important to do in-person instruction at the younger age. You know, the science from a medical standpoint points to that being safer. And also from an educational perspective, I think there's compelling reasons why we should try to focus on that. But our message is, you know, we acknowledge right up that people are in different places and have different, you know, even the anxiety levels and so forth, and that trust that's really requisite to open schools. Organizations across the state are in different places in that regard. So the message is, yeah, we want you to put a priority on that, but we're also acknowledging the real realities of those dynamics at the local level. We'd like to see people work towards that as best they can. I mean, essentially, our guidance to a certain extent has remained consistent. You might be aware that we have step levels in our guidance, and there's step one, step two, and step three. Step one is all schools are closed in the state for in-person instruction. Step three is when they're open for in-person instruction with the least restrictive safety mitigations put in place. Our conditions right now, our medical folks would say, support step three. We could shoot for opening school at step three, but our consensus among all our education folks was we should start at step two. Once again, Vermont's been very cautious on all these issues. And I think, you know, by going to step two, we give districts the opportunity to start fully remote if they need to do that, to start in a hybrid mode or to start in person. But we thought it would be important for districts to practice some of those more stringent requirements. And certainly is our hope that we'd be able to move to step three fairly quickly. But I think, you know, our encouragement of the in-person is firstly just to acknowledge what has been an emerging consensus in the science, but also to acknowledge the realities that not all districts are ready or capable of doing that. But we want them to put some emphasis on that because there's compelling reasons educationally why they should try to do so.
We're speaking with Dan French. He is Vermont's Secretary of Education, and we have a lot of phone calls to get to. We'll get to those in a moment. Before we start to get to the callers, Secretary French, I want to ask this question about physical distancing, because we have heard over and over again that the recommendation is 6 feet. That is the recommended distance to stay safe, not pass things on transmission-wise. But what I'm hearing now is that the physical distancing for schools, for in-person, for elementary school age kids will now be 3 to 6 feet away of distance instead of the full 6 feet. Again, this has been acknowledged pretty much statewide and around the country. 6 feet of distance is what needs to be maintained to reduce the risk of transmission. Why does 3 to 6 feet change now for elementary school age kids?
Yeah, I mean, that change emerged largely from our scientific community that's been involved in advising us, and they felt very strongly that was the approach to implement based on what the data and the research is showing at this point. I would just say, you know, it's also, you mentioned the national perspective, all of what we're contemplating in Vermont is, again, based on our assessment of the Vermont conditions, which, you know, arguably are some of the best in the country. Once again, our positivity rate is 0.5, so all of our guidance is built on that assumption, and that's an important something to highlight, because we have issues of wearing masks and, you know, all those sort of basic precautions that are in place. And physical distancing is a key part of that strategy, but our whole response is really predicated on Vermont having basically not much of the virus in the general community, because whatever's in the community will be in the schools ultimately. So we have to work hard as a state. We have worked hard as a state to ensure that we have such a low rate of virus in our larger community. And that's what's exactly allowing us to contemplate reopening our schools.
Okay, let's go to the lines now. Teresa is on the line from Waterbury Center. Hi, Teresa. You're on with Secretary of Education Dan French.
Hi, yes, thank you so much. I'm wondering if Dan French can speak to the specific scientific metrics of community infection that will be utilized to make the decision on transitioning from phase two to phase one.
Phase three, I think you mean, Teresa. Is that right?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Sure.
Yeah. Thanks. So we use we have guidance that's called decision-making guidance that sort of describes like who's going to make these decisions. So, firstly, I'd say the decision. I'll talk about these step levels, I guess, first. The step levels are on sort of basic precaution levels that the whole state will be following in our schools. So, all schools at all times will be under the same step levels. Though if we do see a specific outbreak, perhaps in one of our more urban areas, we would contemplate putting a specific area into a different step level. But for the most part, schools will be at the same step level all the time. And in our decision-making guidance, we link back to our modeling that we use in the Department of Financial Regulation. So we're using that same modeling that's been guiding all of sort of the turn the spigot decisions to inform the health department's decision around moving the step. So we have a very discrete model that's been created around that. I would say we've had that model for some time as a state, and actually a lot of other states look to our model for that. You know, speaking to what's emerged lately in the national media on sort of those metrics, I think in particular in the last couple of weeks, I noticed when New York announced their intention to reopen, they've identified, as many states have now, the positivity rate, meaning the number of people that are test positive when you give a test. And a lot of states are now pegging their reopening plans on a 5% positivity rate or lower. So New York, for example, is saying they're going to reopen as long as that rate stays below 5%. You know, once again, Vermont's at 0.5%. So our situation is a little different, but I think we have very elaborate modeling. And actually, I think we're going to definitely be contemplating building out additional modeling for K-12 as we go forward.
Teresa, does that answer your question satisfactorily?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Secretary French, I got this. We got this email from Lisa, who listened to yesterday's program. We had a roundtable of teachers on the program with Jane Lindholm, and she heard that, and she writes in, of course teachers want to go back to school in person, but not until it's truly safe. The perspectives on the show confirm and echo my own experiences and wider discussions with teachers and colleagues for the past few weeks. Is the agency of education viewing these voices and concerns as a fringe group of teacher opinions? And if these are not viewed as fringe opinions, can you share how the agency of ed is actively listening to these significant concerns from teachers and making adjustments to the guidance to ensure that we as teachers are heard and valued for our expertise?
Yeah, no, these are a great question. And I could say specifically, you know, we work closely with the Department of Health in particular, and their leadership's been invaluable, firstly, in the development of the guidance and certainly in responding to the many teacher questions that have come forward. Very specifically, I'll point to the fact that our health participated, I believe, in two statewide town halls with teachers through Vermont NEA, and that's precipitated a large number of questions. I forget the total number of questions, but we're answering every single one of those questions that come up and developing, compiling them into frequently asked questions. So we're I think, arguably trying to be very responsive, and we can be very responsive in the state because we're so small. So every single day we're answering questions from teachers, from superintendents, from community members, parents, and we're prepared to do that. And certainly when that comes together, we formulate a frequently asked questions sort of database, and that ultimately then gets fed back into development of guidance. I can give you another very specific example. I think when our initial guidance first came out on the health requirements for schools, we heard immediately from music teachers, you know, and they were very concerned about aerosol and the aspiration, their interest in certainly holding in-face ensembles.
Right.
So the music teachers group, they have a sort of formal group in the state. They've taken our guidance down to a level of application, and we're now having conversations with them about to what extent the agency would publish their work as official guidance. And that's a very iterative conversation back and forth, and they've presented some really compelling arguments and research, and we're sharing that with our medical professionals, and we're going to try to do the best we can to put that out there as regular guidance. But that's an example, I think, of what we can do in Vermont, because we know each other. So I feel like we're very connected to that. We've been very responsive to those concerns.
Let's take a call from Sheila, who's on the line from Rochester. Hi, Sheila.
Hi.
Hi. Are you have a question for Secretary French?
Yes, I am. So I'm a data scientist, and I like looking at numbers, and I follow what the New York Times has been saying about the data very carefully. And there is a statistic, which is the number of excess deaths, which is considered an extremely reliable indicator of the effect of the pandemic. As of today's New York Times, Vermont has 300 excess deaths since March 15th. Which is an indicator that there's something going on in the community, and I'm not going to try to say exactly what that is, but I do wonder if this has been noticed by the education administrators and if they have some comment on what that means for opening schools, because we are now in a second peak.
Thank you for the call, Sheila.
Yeah, I haven't heard that number. I would, my inclination, you know, as you mentioned, I participate in the biweekly press conferences with the governor often. That's a question I would defer to our health department to respond to. I've always had confidence in their work, but their work has been just stellar throughout this response, and I'm sure they could provide a response to that. We haven't seen that statistic be utilized from them in terms of informing our approach. We are increasingly getting new reports of information, I would say headlines, but also research reports and so forth. And I know they're working hard to digest that and consider their implications. So we'd be very interested in understanding that. But I would also, just on the second part of your comment, we haven't seen a surge in Vermont. So once again, in other parts of the country, unfortunately, they are. Also, unfortunately, they're also trying to open their schools in that context, which is probably not the most prudent decision, but that's not Vermont's situation. We're very alert to those changes. In particular, we're monitoring closely the arrival of our higher ed students back to the state, but we don't have a second surge necessarily occurring in Vermont right now.
On yesterday's show, we did hear from a panel of teachers who shared questions and concerns about reopening this fall. We're going to be talking about that in just a moment. Getting back to some of those things. But I want to go first to Judy, who's on the line from St. George. Hi, Judy. You're on the program with Dan French.
Thank you, Mitch. I'm calling because I noted that initially the state of Vermont put forth the guidance that school districts should make their own individual choice based on what would be best for their district. Our district in particular surveyed all the families and the professionals made their best decision in conjunction with the opinions of their families. Now, the state of Vermont is pushing very hard for school districts to take one particular approach, which I find inappropriate and disrespectful. And I'd like to understand, Secretary French, how it is that you can push for this one particular approach when the data is entirely mixed as to whether or not it's safe for children to be in school full-time, much less their teachers, and as to whether or not this distancing of 3 to 6 feet is in fact safe.
Yeah, thanks. Several questions there. It makes me think. I don't think we're being overly strong on the insistence on in-person. And I say insistence, it's, you know, once again, resonating from our medical folks who are saying this is something you really want to look at. But our guidance, is insistent in terms of non-negotiable health requirements that must be put in place to do in-person instruction. Where we had to go in terms of the implementation was to allow the flexibility on districts to choose among essentially three options, in-person, remote, or some combination of those two in what we call hybrid learning. So I think, you know, it's an appropriate balance, and I would argue also one that all states are using in the country. I don't think any state is really pushing one thing or the other because it's just impractical when you get to an implementation level. I think on the other hand, from the state level, we do have a responsibility to speak to, what is sound educational practice, what is health, and clearly, I think, you know, initially, some districts who came out early with their plans, not saying that's your district situation, but saying some came out early, were focused, and from my perspective, a lot on the needs of the teachers and the adults involved in the system and weren't necessarily incorporating parental feedback. I think your district has done an excellent job of surveying and trying to reconcile those different points of view and so forth. But I think, you know, the information on in-person has emerged as consensus in the last 4 weeks. And I think it's a comfort upon us to share that with people and to call to people's attention. I think in terms of the safety issue, again, that's emerged from our health experts as well, that, now's the time to try to approach this in Vermont. We have the conditions that support it. There's compelling educational reasons to do it. But it's a recommendation because each school has different physical plant availability and so forth. So people are still trying to do the best they can. So it's imperfect, I'll be the first to admit. But we are, doing our best to support districts in complying, firstly, with the health guidance, but also trying to find solutions to implement the best instructional solution. And the best instructional solution, I think, is what works for students primarily first, what works for teachers, and certainly what works for parents. And that's going to vary a bit from district to district.
Okay. Judy, thank you very much for that phone call. Secretary French, I do wonder what happens if, and again, I see the bind you're in because you're looking at a couple of things here. You know, Vermont health officials have said, because this is the state with the lowest positivity rate in the nation, that we are probably the best situated to resume in-person learning. I understand that part. I also understand that a lot of these same health officials, pediatric officials I've spoken with have said it's really important to get kids back in school, that there are all sorts of implications long term that could be negative if they don't go back. I guess the problem is, what do you do if that low positivity rate gets put at risk by an outbreak happening in the schools? What's the plan in place should there be a large cluster of cases come out? And the governor has said he's likely to see that happen. He would not be surprised if he saw cases start to crop up in the schools. What is the plan? Is there a quick lockdown plan? Is it going to go back to what happened in March where the schools close? What can be expected?
Yeah, I think it's important to highlight that, when you say I'm in a bind, I don't know if I'm in a bind per se. I think we're all in this together.
Your point is well taken, sir.
It's challenging from a decision-making standpoint to a certain extent. I mean, but once again, I think we've been successful as a state is through set aside some of that complexity and just focus as much as possible on the health science and let that inform our decision making, because this, you know, this, that's an emerging body of knowledge. This is a new virus. We don't have any experience with it in our human condition. So we have to listen closely to the science as we're making these decisions. But when we get into the application of the science, we have to anticipate, and our plan does, which is what we've been calling everyone's attention to, is that the plan is certainly based on the assumption that there's limited amount of virus in our communities. But here are the other steps we are taking, because the next step in the guidance talks about if there is virus inside the school environment, how do you protect its spread? And that's where issues or strategies such as wearing a mask or social distancing become critically important inside the school. So step two inside the guidance is about stopping the spread. And then the next level in the guidance talks about, okay, what do you do when someone is determined to be sick inside the school? How do you process that individual, isolate them, and so forth? So, I mean, built into the assumption of our model is, you know, firstly, low levels of virus in our broader society, but then here are the practical steps we're going to have to follow. And I think, you know, if it's helpful in terms of the anxiety piece, I think we can once again point to the data in Vermont and our experience. We've had, firstly, very solid experience operating childcare. You know, since the beginning of the emergency, we've kept our childcare infrastructure online, and we've had a lot of success in terms of managing positive cases in that context. But then, very specifically, we've had, I'll say, outbreaks. We've had clusters in Winooski and Fairhaven. And our health department was able to manage that very well, once again, largely based, firstly, on this understanding of our context that we have very low positivity rates to begin with. And that's why we've established, you know, back to that statistical model on the earlier caller's point, we have a model that establishes those guardrails very clearly. So we have, you know, a high level of testing, we have a good model, and we understand where those sort of lines are in terms of our response. So we feel pretty comfortable right now that we can manage that. But that's something, once again, we're alert to in case, you know, the number of cases increases.
Well, related to this, we do have this comment from Jennifer, who wrote to us and said, at the governor's press conference earlier this week, state epidemiologist Patsy Kelso said that if there was a COVID case in the classroom, it would not mean that all students and staff in that class would be considered a close contact for purposes of contact tracing and testing. She says this is extremely irresponsible and dangerous. Parents are going to want to know, if there is a COVID case in the classroom, why would the state not contact all families and test all people in a classroom? Why would you not err on the side of caution?
Yeah, I mean, I was standing on a stage with Dr. Kelso. I mean, she made much more elaborate comments than that, but this is, you know, sometimes the hard piece to hear, but there's a science to doing the contact tracing. It's nothing new necessarily for this virus. And I will say, I have been learning a lot over the last couple of months about public health issues. I'm by no means an expert in it. You know, the strategy employed, once again, it's been successful in Winooski, has been successful in Fairhaven, is a very focused approach in as quickly as possible, trying to do that contact tracing. But once again, it's the strategy is really, for me, my understanding of it, is situated in this context where there's a low probability of the virus to begin with, so we can act very swiftly to contain it. And I believe Dr. Lean pointed to that the Winooski cluster, if you will, is now closed. And I think the Fairhaven one closed previously. So, I mean, it's been a proven approach. And we also know, to the point about doing the more elaborate testing, I think Dr. Kelso spoke to that as well earlier in the week. We have some experience in its emerging in this idea that testing asymptomatic individuals, particularly in an environment where there's a high degree of suppression, doesn't necessarily lead to useful information. So that's also a challenging thing, I think, to communicate to folks. But, you know, we'll, once again, we're prepared. We have the modeling and the insight into our trends to change our disposition towards that very quickly. And we're very nimble in terms of reacting to the conditions. But right now we feel pretty confident that, you know, we can contain the virus. We've demonstrated our ability to do that. But then secondly, that, that now's the time to try to reopen schools.
Okay. On yesterday's show, as I mentioned before, we heard from a panel of teachers who shared questions and concerns about reopening this fall. Amy Braun is a kindergarten and first grade teacher at Rochester Elementary School, and she says she's concerned about the mental health of her students And she had this question for you, Secretary French.
What are you choosing as far as the Department of Education? Are you choosing the emotional health of our families and our students, or are you choosing to put some academic pressure on us to all catch up on what we're missing? So as an educator, I hope that I'm given an opportunity to really focus on the mental health of these kids as opposed to trying to catch people up.
So, yeah, I think she's asking there about, again, the emotional part of that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And to a certain extent, I think it's a false choice. I mean, it's not going to be one or the other. I mean, I think to our credit and largely emerging from our medical folks, because I think as educators, we are strongly attuned to the SEL. We call SEL, social emotional learning needs of students. But even our medical people, I won't say even our medical people, they were very insistent in the initial draft for guidance that we include a piece on mental health in that because they're closely related and it's not one or the other. I think to her question, I would say, certainly from the agency's perspective, we are very concerned, you know, because schools, once again, are conditioned and have routines that the fall and then the initial reopening of schools should not be about the traditional assessment of academic progress and putting emphasis on compliance with standards and so forth. I think if I were to choose among the two, I would agree the emphasis needs to be on the social emotional support. And I would agree also that's really one of the more compelling educational reasons why we should reopen school. Just the act of reopening schools itself and the routines that schools bring to the lives of our students is probably our most important intervention in their lives right now. In the last couple of weeks, been thinking of interventions for students. Our biggest intervention we can put on the table is just to turn schools back on and get them back into their routines with their peers and so forth.
Let's go to Molly, who is on the line with us from Dummerston. Hi, Molly. You are with Secretary Dan French.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call, and thank you, Mr. French. I'm a fourth-grade teacher in southern Vermont, and my question is about the feasibility of hybrid models for elementary schools in particular, as I've seen them proposed around the state. Just a little context, the remote teaching that we all did March to June was a very full-time job with, you know, instruction online through Zoom, one-on-one, small group, extensive family support, weekly professional development, et cetera. And when I look at the model we're being asked to do now, I see myself in school 4 days a week with half of my class each of, you know, 2 days, Monday, Tuesday, and two Thursday, Friday, while my nine-year-olds are working independently at home, and I'm given one day to do the remote components of that instruction, or I'm somehow magically supporting the nine-year-olds working independently while I'm doing in-person instruction. So what I'd like to understand is how you see elementary teachers simultaneously holding a 100% time remote job with an 80% in-person job and doing all of that.
Yeah, I would agree what you're describing is not practical. I will say by way of commentary, I'm married to an elementary school teacher who was a kindergarten teacher for a number of years and currently is a sixth grade teacher, and I watched her jump into remote learning this spring. So I know it's not as simple as just, you know, turning on a computer and doing it. It's a very intensive process. So districts do need to build in consideration for not just the planning time, but just, I'll say, the logistics of navigating those issues. And I can imagine, as we've heard from a lot of teachers who have young children, that adds a whole nother dimension of complexity to what we're dealing with. So I'm sympathetic to your situation. I would encourage your district to build a schedule around making that doable for everyone.
And of course, there's problems too with some kids who can't even access the online tools they need to have that remote learning. We know about many of the challenges in Vermont just with getting internet connected to some areas, and those are issues that are going to have to be dealt with as well. We have Michael on the line from Waitsfield. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Dan, it's Michael Hawk, your recently retired statewide assessment director.
Congratulations on your retirement.
And thanks for giving us your title, Michael, straight out of the gate. I appreciate that.
That's quite all right. So, Dan, I spent my first months as a retired person watching my elementary school teacher wife and her colleagues step up to a problem that was never envisioned and where there's no precedence on how to teach kids during a pandemic. And the only thing that I felt was lacking, and this won't surprise you, is some set of common measures that could be used by schools and by teachers, first of all, to track progress of their students across the year, and also for schools to use to determine whether the models they'd adopted were working for all students. And it just seems to me that now that the state is going to permit school districts to come up with their own models for reopening schools, that having measures like that would be more important than ever. And I say this with a fair amount of bias, but I think that Vermont has one of the best statewide assessment systems in the country, which is fully digital and could be delivered to kids at home. And also, you started a ambitious initiative last year to provide measures of lexiles and quantiles, which would be a great student measure. So my question is, are you and your colleagues discussing either recommending or perhaps mandating use of our existing measures or something new that you have in the works so that we can determine if kids are making progress and whether or not the models adopted by schools have been working for kids' benefits?
Thanks for the call, Michael.
Yeah, we are, Michael, in terms of we're working on it. I think, you know, we did move forward with the Lexile partnership. It is it's something we're anxious to turn our attention to. I do intend to collect some basic data as schools reopen around what opportunities are being provided to students. And I think, you know, once again, the state's obligation to provide some oversight and to ensure equity and equal opportunity for students and high quality. But right now, honestly, that's on the back burner to the question earlier about the choice between social emotional learning or academics. Right now, honestly, logistics is on the front burner. So we have to support districts and just the logistics support to reopen, priority number one. Priority two, to deal with the anxiety, appropriate anxiety, I would argue, due to this unprecedented situation that we're in, and do the best we can to support our students, staff, and their families. But I think pretty quickly thereafter, we're going to want to start thinking about, and I think this is honestly part of the hopeful conversation, as challenging as reopening is, we need to transition to thinking about recovery, if you will, which is a phrase we use in emergency response, because the virus will come to an end. We know the effects of this emergency on students and their families is significant, as it has been on all of us, but we want to begin to start to consider how to wrap our arms around the impact of the emergency on students, both from an academic and a developmental standpoint. So we want to start having those conversations at the state level. When I say state level, I mean among all Vermonters, all Vermont educators, to figure out how to provide the sort of consistent measures. And I would agree, we have some tools in our toolkit already to do that. But like a lot of things in Vermont, we just have to consider using them probably more systematically than we have in the past.
We have this comment, a question from Susan in Shaftesbury, who asks, what are the suggestions for working parents or guardians who work and can't leave their children at home alone? Is there a way to assist with child care costs if providers can be found at all? Any recommendations for Susan?
Yeah, this is probably our front burner, I would say, logistic challenge right now. The child care implications are significant, and we're working hard. And I think our agency of Child Development Division inside the Agency of Human Services is taking the lead on this. So I would firstly, on an immediate concern, point the caller towards their website on the Child Development Division in Vermont. If you Google that up with child care, you'll see some options there and an opportunity to obtain resources as well. But this is a priority for us. It's a very challenging problem. As you know, we had inadequate child care in the state before the emergency began, and certainly it's been exacerbated, particularly with the implementation of the hybrid models across district to district. So it's something we're very attentive to, and we're working hard to come up with a better solution.
We may have a bit of a follow-up on that as we go to the phones again. Kim is on the line from Facetown, I believe. Hi, Kim.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Secretary French, I was curious if and when the governor and you might take it upon yourselves to insist on a particular number of in-student days in districts that are reticent for whatever reason to do that. I live in a district that is only in Washington West, actually, where Michael Hawk also resides, where the superintendent Bridget Neese has decided only to offer one day of in-person instruction, even though we have physical space in many of our elementary schools. She's been trying to close two of them for quite some time. And I don't know why that is, that she only offered one day when, and other, you know, I hear Berlin is offering 5 days of in-person, and it's really an impossible situation for people who work. And so while I know the governor and you are hopeful that superintendents and teachers will want to do more in-person days, I don't think that's going to happen in the district where I live voluntarily. And I'd like to know how you might address that in the near future. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. It's a challenging dynamic. And I would say, the question sometimes comes up more generally as to, why aren't we proposing a more top-down approach that would sort of create that mythical consistency that we're always aspiring to in Vermont, I guess. So if I play that out, we have a couple options. One would be to impose remote learning from the top down, and not all districts can do that. And then secondly, the health conditions don't support that. The health conditions clearly point to the need to do in person. So the other option would be to impose in-person instruction. But here too, it becomes problematic because not all districts have the staff available to do that. Might not have the facilities that could be accommodating of the stringent requirements that we've created in the health guidance. So we run into logistical challenges either way if we were to impose a solution. So it does require districts to, in a very challenging situation for school boards and superintendents, but they need to reconcile the competing needs in some cases. Some of those needs are just basically logistic considerations of what's possible, but then you have competing interests sometimes on the part of parents and teachers, and those aren't necessarily what I'm observing. Those aren't necessarily monoliths of opinion. So there's diversity of need inside of teachers. I've heard from a number of teachers, for example, who have childcare needs themselves, who would be appreciative of full-time in-person instruction. I have teachers who clearly can't teach in person, who would appreciate having more of a hybrid option. So all those things, unfortunately, have to be factored in. And the same, I would argue, goes with parents. We have parents who are, like yourself, more interested in person. We have parents who are adamantly interested in remote learning, as is represented in our increased numbers in homeschooling. So it's a very challenging environment politically at the local level to try to reconcile these interests. But our decision at the state level to position that decision-making locally wasn't based on a sort of kicking a can down the road, so to speak. It was really the logistical challenges locally. Each master agreement is different. Each physical plan is different. There's different conditions, different interests on the part of parents and resources and so forth. So there's no other way to do it, I would argue. And that's I would observe that that's pretty much how every state's approaching it. There's no other way to do it. But to your question, go ahead, Mitch. I didn't mean to.
Well, no, it's okay. I did have a question about staffing, because you had mentioned staffing there in your answer to Kim. And, I'm wondering if you've heard from teachers around the districts, are there enough staff available? Are subs ready to go if the staffs aren't? And who will pay for more help if it's needed? Because, you've said that schools could schedule things in, but really, what does that mean? Teachers don't seem to have the time. Budgets have been passed. I'm just wondering, where's that money going to come from if you are going to have trouble with staffing? What if teachers get sick? That kind of thing.
Yeah, I think it's, once again, I would say part of the decision-making on the hybrid approach in particular was to give districts another tool to navigate these challenges. And our school districts are highly vulnerable to logistical considerations, and I would put staffing as one of the most critical ones of those in that criteria.
Well, do you have a general idea about, is there enough staff? If the schools were to open tomorrow, would you have teachers enough to staff the classrooms?
I would say we don't. I don't know at the state level yet the answer to that question. Right now, I think those are the hard conversations that are going on in districts, particularly as they settle into their plans. So I think the first step is for districts to build those plans, and certainly I think they're factoring in staff availability into those conversations. But then I know many districts are now turning and having those conversations with staff, who feels comfortable doing this, and who would prefer to teach online. So I think it's a little early, but in terms of funding, we don't have any additional state funding on the table to deal with this, but we do have federal dollars that are coming out. So, and this refers to the CARES Act, which comes out in a couple pots of money. One's called the Coronavirus Relief Fund, and the legislature has given school districts about $50 million in that area. About $40 million of that can be used for reimbursable expenses, including staffing costs. And then districts have access to the emergency secondary elementary school relief fund from the federal government. That's about $27 million that's rolling out now. So they do have some additional federal dollars available. I would say that those dollars are really just going to help with the initial reopening of school. The longer term costs are ones that we're going to need additional federal support to deal with.
And what about things like you mentioned very early on in the conversation, sports are going to resume, masks are going to be required for virtually every sport except cross country running, football is going to be 7-on-7, no contact, that kind of thing. But, you know, we had the question earlier, too, about singing and people who are involved in music wanting to know, well, if you can get the schools, the sports going, why can't you do that with singing? And again, different concerns here, but what is the answer to that question?
Yeah, I would say that's the place we're going in terms of the application of the health guidance, which we still view as sort of being a cornerstone of the state's sort of guidance, if you will, to reopening schools. So, you know, the issue of sports is how do we implement the health guidance in the context of sports? We have, as I mentioned, a question that's going back and forth on music. We have questions going on in CTE centers, career technical centers. So we are working to deal with each of those individual areas as they pop up. And oftentimes those are originating from teachers themselves. So we're happy to engage with their expertise to understand how to apply the health guidance in their context.
We have time for just one more question that I want to put to you, Secretary French, and I appreciate you answering these questions today. They're not easy. But what happens? We are getting a lot of questions from folks who are saying, you know, it's one thing to talk about numbers and Vermont's low positivity rate, but these are people's children. And you know, you're an educator. You know what this is about. If a child gets sick, if a child brings home COVID and gets a family member sick and that family member ends up dying, I mean, Vermont's good numbers right now could very much quickly change. Are you prepared? Are you ready to have a plan in place to either shut the schools down or go to a plan B immediately if it looks like this is getting out of hand in a bad way?
Yeah, we do have that plan. I think it's articulated in both our health guidance and our decision-making guidance. So we imparted that right from the beginning. So we're prepared. We're confident in our numbers right now, but we're fully prepared to react to any situation that might emerge in that regard. So people should have confidence in that, our ability to respond. And once again, our health department's done such a great job. You can point to both our ability to manage childcare, that's been ongoing since March, and also, you know, the Winooski and Fairhaven clusters is a good example of our ability to do that.
And just very briefly, 10 seconds or so, are those plans made public at all, or are those things you're just talking about internally?
Oh, no, they're public documents. You can, and actually in this revision to the health guidance, there's a fairly elaborate conversation about how we do contact tracing, and the decision-making guidance has been out for a couple of weeks.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll have links to that on our website at vpr.org. Secretary of Education Dan French, thank you for the time today.
Well, thank you. Anytime.